Yeah, can I quickly say that you brought up two things which are
talking
very, very
mic.
Dear to my heart. One is the role of the presenter in a television science program, that many people see scientists as being sort of very disinvolved and boring and all that kind of thing. And there was Robert getting really sort of tucked into it. It was great, and I think we need more TV science presenters. We have a fashion in Britain at the moment to have comedians presenting programs, and they're absolutely crap and bullshit and all that sort of thing. So let's forget about that. Let's get real scientists like these guys presenting the programmes. And Robert was great. And the other thing is, I just have to quickly say, I love Australian wine, and I hope that Robert was drinking a good wine.
Did you want to comment on anyone over here from that one?
The things they do for science, this is wonderful. Yeah, I think we all should do more of this. Yeah, demonstrating the principles from first principles
yes.
like that.
But brilliant. The thing is, yeah, but it was demonstrated, wasn't it? I mean, we did learn. You know, we were finding out what was going on. Yeah.
But Alison, I understand that when this program was shown in America and Discovery Channel has to cut for a few minutes because they have longer commercial breaks, that this particular scene was taken out because they couldn't show inebriation on American television.
That is very interesting, which we'll follow up on, the editorializing of that, cutting it out. Heather?
Can I just throw a real curveball into this? And I'd be really interested, obviously, with the sorts of countries, the sorts of companies that make the sort of science that we see on television, it's very white, Anglo-Saxon, middle-class science. Mm. Or that's how it comes across.
Well, as I say, I apologise for choosing tapes that aren't.
No, well, you know, that's the majority of what we see. It's not necessarily what you choose, it's how it is.
It's a very good point. And one of the things that we were criticised for in Universe, oddly enough, was using too many American scientists. And it was part of the, if you like, the dynamic of the programme. It is cheaper for us in Britain to fly to America and to fly within the United States because you have the educated scientists who have to justify their grant applications verbally, so they're better at speaking than British and European scientists, that the internal flights are cheaper, the scenery is fab, car hire is cheap,
yes.
Crews are cheap, and it, you know, this actually very much influences the whole dynamic of a television programme.
Yeah.
Actually, I must make a little plug for Future Tense. I've been trying to resist it, but I can't. One of the really nice things about it is that a lot of stories are done all over the world, including the Third World, you know, so you see science in Asia, in Malaysia, those fantastic stories and so on. But anyhow, that was awful of me. Sorry. I want to talk, I think we need to move on about this editing. You mentioned a very interesting thing that the Discovery couldn't cope with their presenter getting drunk. They cut him out. Now, Geoffrey and I were involved in a program, What's Your Poison, that went out on ABC and has just gone out again on Lifestyle TV. And there were five drugs that we looked at, everyday drugs, and the last one was ecstasy. Geoffrey, you tell the story of what happened to our program when it went to America.
Yes, it was very interesting. This series of programs were sort of like, I guess you could say, like a user's guide to five different drugs. We wanted to let people know exactly what they were in for if they drank a cup of tea, smoked a cigarette, smoked a joint, had a glass of wine, or took an ecstasy tablet. And we were wanting to use the latest that science could tell us about what that drug does to you, and that is the things that you're, the pleasurable effects, the reason that you're taking the drug, but at the same time, what are the side effects? What might it also be doing to you? Now, in the case of the ecstasy episode, we had a bit of a problem because there's hardly any science been done, or there hadn't at the time we made the program 4 years ago. And the other problem is that it is almost entirely, it's a drug that's almost entirely associated with teenagers or people in their 20s. And we thought, okay, now we want to get this across so that everybody will get a sense of A, what it's like to take ecstasy, and B, how dangerous is it? So on the one hand, we combed the world to find the few scientists we could who had some information about ecstasy. The scientific research that had been done was very interesting. Some said, well, it looks as if some years down the track, it might cause problems in the brain. It looks that way. The other scientists said, we've done extensive tests, either on humans, but mainly on laboratory animals, and we can't find any sign of a problem. So there was a clear split there.
And we
and
showed
what
those.
Happened was, and we showed that in the version of Watch Your Poison Ecstasy that went to air in Australia. But when the series was purchased for broadcast in the United States, amazingly, they cut out all the references that indicated, well, perhaps this drug doesn't have any problems.
Yeah, yeah.
What you were left with was a program that was presenting only one side of the research. All it told people about was, this stuff is going to cause you problems as far as we know. And it does, it raises a very interesting situation in editorializing. How do you decide which bits you're going to show?
It would be true, wouldn't it, though, to say that, you know, I mean, we get, a lot of people suspect that goes on. I don't think it goes on very much. Do you? I mean, that's a story that I think stands out because, you know, it's reasonably unusual. I mean, when we, as program makers, are trying to make science programs, we try and get the balance right, right?
Well, one of the situations that we found, it wasn't so much actually altering the balance of a discussion, but it was, again, coming back to the Americans' notion of morality. We made a program called Body Atlas quite a long time before Robert Winston did his, and one of the programs, half-hour programs for the Learning Channel, which is part of Discovery Channel, was about gestation. So we had a mother and we followed her for the 9 months through until the birth. And it's a long story. We had to had a lot of problems about getting the camera woman in there when the birth was happening, getting the agreement of everybody who was involved in it. But it was a wonderful birth. The baby came out fine. It was perfect. Again, one of our worries, if the baby came out deformed after all that time, we'd have real problems. And it was a beautiful sequence. We did the rough cut. We sent it across to Discovery Channel. They said, fine. We did the fine cut, which is like exactly how to look with the script in place, but before the professional voiceover comes into it. And they said, that's great. So we did the professional voiceover. And then they came back to us and said, this program is not acceptable. And we said, I beg your pardon, but you accepted up the fine cut stage. And they said, we've now consulted our legal department, and they say that because the woman's pubes are visible, her pubic area is visible, we cannot show this on television. So we said, we pulled our rank and said, you've approved the fine cut, so you've got to pay this for this program and accept it. And they took it. When it went to air, they had gone through it again.
Air brushing?
And they had pixelated the woman's pubic area, so it was like flashy.
Nothing like drawing attention to it.
It was like you drew attention to it in a way you wouldn't have noticed before.
Like putting a huge arrow all over it.
Okay, well, we've only got about 15 minutes left, so we'll move on. The next tape we've chosen,
just one point about the editorialising. I think it starts way before the film actually gets made. But when we were first putting together Dragons of Galapagos, we do a lot of co-productions with National Geographic because they have vast amounts of money compared with the ABC. And we had this meeting in Bristol, and there were, we call them the suits, about 7 suits from Geographic sitting around this table and 3 of us. And they said, pitch it. So we pitched it. We had a lot of pretty pictures and all this sort of thing. And we talked about the marine iguanas and the way they go into the water and feed on seaweed. And the very first question was, do sharks eat the marine iguanas? And we said, because we were prepared for all this, we said, no, there's been no records whatsoever. Basically, the thrust of so many American documentaries, particularly in natural history, is always predation, predation, predation. Yes. They want to know the very first time what predates, what eats it, and what does it eat.
Which read ratings.
Yeah,
ratings.
And so right from the very point, before you even shoot a foot of film, you're steered in the direction of a particular thread which goes for predators. How many television programs do you see that have got lions, hyenas, leopards, polar bears, grizzly bears, killer whales? You know, you can just go on and on and on and on. White pointer sharks. How many white pointer sharks films are there? Because this is basically what rates in America. It's what Discovery, and Discovery are incredibly detailed about what their audience profile is. Their audience profile is something like 25 to 47. They're people with an income of between $75,000 and $150,000 a year. They basically averagely get home at 8 o'clock at night and will watch television with a TV dinner till 10 o'clock. What do they want to see? They want to see war films. They want to see films about submarines, about F-111s, about hyenas being eaten by lions, or whatever. Or,
and we can't make our programmes without their budgets, so we get
absolutely
sucked in.
So yeah. We are dictated to a strong degree by American taste.
I couldn't agree even more. We actually, as programme makers, we have to sit in on sessions with these guys from Discovery Channel where they give us the market profile, and we have to sit through these presentation sessions, and I'm afraid American TV market profile is dictating world television.
Mm. Well, that completely accords with the way America runs the rest of its morality and its television. I think the contrast of the two points, that you can't have sex but you can have violence or predation, is completely borne out in their newscasting, the way they run their films, the classifications that are given to film. You know, it's completely universal. But I think that point about editorialising is really critical. I mean, the choice that you make to cover one story over another, I mean, your editorial decisions are not so dissimilar from mine about the fact that we choose to make certain programs along, you know, directed towards certain topic areas, and that in itself is an editorial decision. Yeah. And something that the viewing public is becoming a lot more savvy about, certainly in terms of news broadcasting they are. Mm. Well, what sides of the story you get as opposed to those that you don't.
We've actually got as our next clip a clip which is specifically been chosen because we wanted to discuss this issue of editorialising. And this particular programme that we're going to show, I don't know how many of you would have seen it, but it was called Against Nature. And it went out on ABC television. It was made for Channel 4 by a company called RDF. But it's a particular example of having an agenda, having a real agenda, setting out in this case to challenge the creed of the Greenies, of the environmental movement. I think, Jeff, you better just set up the clip so that people understand what they're going to see.
Yes, this particular excerpt that you're going to see comes from the second of the two episodes of Against Nature. And what they were setting out to convince the audience of in the second episode was that the story that we're told about how the world is in some countries becoming overpopulated and too many people is part of the reason why there's such pollution and such misery, they were setting out to say, sorry, that's a complete myth.
Okay, let's have clip number 7, please.
Environmentalists say that people are the problem. Too many of them can only lead to famine and environmental degradation. But people in countries with high population densities are by and large better fed and live in nicer environments. The Netherlands, for example, has a population of 381 people per square kilometer. This is more than three times as high as China's population density of 126 people per square kilometer. Africa is very sparsely populated indeed. Even discounting desert and semi-desert areas, there is still only 48 people per square kilometre, compared with 238 people per square kilometre in the UK. And despite what the Greens suggest, the result of all these people in the first world has not been environmental degradation. Some of the most densely populated areas of the world also happen to be growing more trees than ever before. In Europe, there are 30% more trees today than there were 50 years ago.
It's a common perception that we're running out of trees. And in fact, what the facts show is that in the United States and Canada, and in most of Western Europe, we have been growing more trees than we've been cutting down for really the last 40 years. Trees and forests provide a good example of how it's possible to have a growing economy and a growing population and a thriving environment. the lesson from trees really applies across the environment. You see that we have cleaner air today, we have cleaner water, we grow more food at less impact on the land, we have more wildlife diversity than we've had before, and we've done all this while having a growing economy and a growing population.
Well, fact or fiction? who on the panel saw this? Nigel?
Well, I think actually coming from Britain, we have here, and I'm at danger of actually cutting off all future commissions from Channel 4, who are one of our major funders, we have here an unholy alliance. Channel 4 is the alternative channel in Britain for factual programming as opposed to the BBC, and its remit is to present the non-consensus view. In fact, oddly enough, Universe was commissioned by Channel 4, and that was something of an anomaly, is a word I can never ever say. Channel 4 likes to go to the outside ideas, whether it's in comedy, whether it's in current affairs, whether it's in factual programmes. And RDF is an independent production company, and as one of RDF's competitors, you should take what I say with an enormous pinch of salt, of course. But they go for controversy, and they're likely to pick up any story that comes up in New Scientist or The Guardian or wherever, where there's a large measure of controversy, and go down that route. And I'm not against controversy myself, but I think a programme like this is presenting one side of obviously a very complex issue, as we've seen, and presenting that as fact. And there's a lot of backlash against this particular series in Britain. I don't think very many people took it as being a balanced discussion of the topics, and it was set out deliberately to be controversial. But coming back to what we're saying about talking to dinosaurs, there was never a disclaimer at the front saying this is one side of the argument, not the entire argument.
Well, is it, as the acting general manager of ABC Television at the time said, just the sort of programme the ABC should be screening because it explores different and unfashionable territories and will certainly generate discussion and debate?
What is doing?
Well, that's right. Bert, you had a thought about this, I think.
I mean, this was one series which I saw the trailers for on ABC and decided I definitely wasn't going to watch. Even from the trailers, you could see the distortion that was likely to be presented. And I just thought, I just couldn't stomach watching three episodes of this particular programme. Now, I wouldn't call myself a deep green sort of conservative, but I do care about the planet. And that one was just so one-sided, even in the trailers, that I thought, this is absurd. I mean, you may as well present creation science or pornography. I mean, if you're going to have a debate about something, well, what doesn't get stopped getting shown on TV? I mean, that was just so one-sided that... And I can't say I saw the series, because I didn't, but I can't imagine it really did put any disclaimers in at the start to say that this was one person's political... almost a political statement, or perhaps it was an economic statement. I don't know who really funded this programme.
Well, is there a problem here, though, in that... We're confronted with a program that presented a really radical point of view, and a lot of people criticised it because of the point of view it took, because of the stand it took. But by the same token, here we are saying, well, all these other programs where we make assumptions about what's the main feeling in science at the moment, and we, for example, might create an animation sequence to depict something, and we say, well, look, that's true as well. How do you split the difference? Aren't we in danger of censoring here and saying, well, look, we don't like this point of view, so we shouldn't be making this programme?
No, can I quickly interrupt here? I think we're also looking at the production values of different TV production companies, and RDF actually have a sort of mission statement that they are going to be controversial. Whatever the perceived wisdom is, they're going to actually question that and make a deliberately sort of debatable programme. So I think, you know, when you see... It's very funny. In Britain now, in Radio Times, which is our TV listings magazine, they don't actually have the name of the production company at the end of the programme. So it's rather like when you're a scientist and you see the names of the authors of a paper on that paper, you say, OK, I really accept Marcy and Butler. They discovered 33 planets going around other stars. What you have to do is to say, look at the production company's name. If it's RDF, you know it's spiked. It's going to be controversial. If you see other production companies, you know they're going to give a balanced view, and I think that's very important.
But how is that... known to a lay audience.
Exactly.
It's not known to a lay audience.
No. So, I think where it comes to the broadcaster, and in Britain we only have 5 terrestrial channels, and only 2 of them put out, 2.5 put out serious science. The BBC Two does, BBC One to, does.
A similar sort of thing here. SBS and ABC.
Which I think gives the broadcasters much more of a responsibility for actually putting out balanced programmes. And I've got no problem with controversy being put on the screen, but I think there does need to be some way that the audience gets a balanced view somehow. I mean, it could be a whole series like that, and then it could be another series which takes the opposite point of view. I mean, it doesn't have to be within the same programme.
I agree entirely. I think there's an extra dimension as well, which is the consequences of some of these programs. It's not astronomy, it's not natural history. Sure. It's the consequences of having huge populations or knocking down all the rainforests really carry forward for generations and generations and generations. Mm. So it's not just a kind of an idle program for a little bit of idle debate. It has very serious consequences. And you can't just let it just get thrown out there to the general arena without some kind of moderating force in there somewhere along the way, either a sort of a discussion session somewhere in the program. Just having it out there as anyone can deal with this. I don't think that's a sensible, responsible way for a national broadcaster such as the ABC to be acting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. I mean, the weak link in the whole of the broadcasting chain are the commissioning editors. And the commissioning editors, the people who dictate what television you see, are the commissioning editors. And they are, by and large, and if I can swear in a major way, old women of all sexes. And they really are dim, they're dumb, and they want to try to do something radical all the time. And a lot of people have resigned from television because of the commissioning editors. I actually have resigned from Pioneer Productions because I cannot abide dealing with certain people in this world who dictate, I would like to have this on television because it's radical, it's new, and it's controversial. And I've decided to go back to being a presenter again because I refuse to deal with these people who are, we all call them the gatekeepers, the portcullises and things like that. And they're completely and utterly dumb.
They make it difficult for us. Move on, but please.
Sure, I'll just be very quick about this. I mean, a couple of points. I think that perhaps RDF would say, we've had series after series of David Suzuki, so, you know, as the ABC would suggest, that perhaps we take a particular line in our broadcast because there are 3 other commercial stations that perhaps present another point of view. I mean, that's just a possibility of how they would argue their case. But also, I mean, Mr. Hayward, who was the talent on that, and what strikes me from that specific example of it is true of everybody, a talking head on these sorts of programs, is we have no concept of their bona fides. I mean, they might be complete Fruit Loops. The Pacific Research Centre, or whatever it was called, might be a front for a milling operation or a wood chipper or whatever, but we don't know that. And he's presented as an expert in ecosystems and population. Yeah. But as a lay audience, we're constantly, you know, presented with these people who apparently know the truth, but we don't know where their truth lies.
Mm. You might be interested to know that apparently the Independent Press Council in Britain found that there was no evidence that that programme was biased or inaccurate, but only that some interviewees were misled and unfairly edited. So there you go.
I think, though, just a tiny little piece, I think we have to be a little bit careful about branding bias. If you look at our press here in Australia and who actually owns 75-80% of our press.
Absolutely.
So, you know, look, this is a tiny example of what we face every day when we pick up the newspaper.
Very good point. Very good point. We had other things to show you. We are very close to having to finish, so I think we'll move straight to our last tape. This is tape number 10. And the reason we wanted to show you this is it's an excerpt from FAQ, which is the ABC's latest new science programme. And it sort of brings us a bit back to... it could be called FAQ, why is it so, really? All these tricks of the trade, all these $100 million graphics budgets have all gone out the window. We've got a presenter and he's got some guests. And... and they're going to chat about science in a very informal way. And we're just going to show you a clip from the program called How to Live Forever, where Adam Spencer, the comedian presenter, is just about to introduce the fourth guest, having already introduced the first three. And this fourth guest is Dr. John Flood. Please.
Citizen.
The smile muscle.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's so sweet when it could have been so smutty. And Dr. John Flood, plastic surgeon who has performed craniofacial reconstruction in Dallas, Texas, and now works at St. Vincent's Hospital. John, you're a plastic surgeon. Just say you had me alone in a room for half an hour with a chisel. What could you do for me?
Only half an hour.
Well, we won't be hearing much from John on the show. Let's roll. Our final scientists of song for this series are a bouffanted band called Alphaville, who dared to ask a big question back in 1984. Tests at the time proved these hairdos could withstand a nuclear winter, so these masters of moose had their hopes of super longevity pinned mainly on styling products and jumpsuits. 16 years later, science has pulled a few more tangible things from the fountain of youth. It's now threatening to ask, do you really want to live forever, and actually offer you the chance to do it. Forever. Researchers tweaking the genes of creatures from small worms to fruit flies have been able to double their lifespans. Our daily discovery of 2,000 new genes offers the potential to understand why we age and then to prevent it with gene therapy and drugs that might virtually eliminate some of our biggest diseases. The cloning of sheep, cows and monkeys could lead us to farm new body parts to replace the ones that get old. And if all that seems far-fetched, remember the research published in the Lancet Medical Journal late last year, which suggested that playing bingo was an effective way to stave off death. Until your number's up, I guess. Howsie! A question for the panel, and indeed the bigwigs at the ABC. Why do we have to die? What is it that makes us die, Roger?
Well, I think a more interesting question is why we live so long. And it's really quite remarkable that our body's tissues and cells have so much built-in repair capacity that they're able to keep themselves
and
going.
And so it goes
an
on.
An amazing machine that can keep going for 70, 80, 90,
we have to stop it there. But I mean, you get the flavour of FAQ.
I think the most interesting thing about that is that I can't help but be struck by how, in a way, it's not that different from Why Is It So back in the mid-60s. Yeah. You've got one person in front of... Well, in that case, it was one person in front of a camera. Now there's five people in front of a camera with very little in the way of props. Sure, there's a video clip to sort of spice it up and zip it along. But it comes back to the power of a personality on screen and talking about ideas and thrashing them backwards and forwards. So, I don't know, maybe we don't need expensive graphics and maybe we don't need to be... Yes, we do need to be going into the craters on the Galapagos, I'm sure.
Yeah, but we also need enthusiastic presenters, mate. I mean, that's what we really do need. I mean, I get a lot of people who stop me in the street in London and say, hey, I saw your latest TV show, it was so thrilling, you know, you really communicated well. And I think we're going back to the era of the communicator, who can be somebody who's qualified in science. You know, shock horror.
Do our scientists think that having a good laugh about science is a good way to go?
FAQ was an outstanding success. Mm. It was, as far as the people I spoke to throughout, you know, all the walks of life, they really enjoyed it. It was one of the great times to popularise and bring science back from the ivory towers, bring it to the shop front, and it was a great opportunity, I think, for the scientists to have a good time just discussing it. It was like the panel. It was a scientific version of the panel. Yeah. And I think both programs are really, really successful, and I want to see FAQ back.
But how do researchers feel about making light of things like that?
Why not? Why do we have to keep... Like, the problem is, our research might be the cutting edge of our particular area, but let's blunten the edge a little bit and bring it to the masses. This is where our research funding comes from. This is where we have to actually justify our existence these days. So I think these kind of programs are a fantastic vehicle for us to get out there. Why not?
Lynn.
And what it provides is that opportunity to do what we've all suggested to some degree or another is necessary, which is to raise the contentions and to actually recognise that there is a diversity of view about certain issues. And what struck me throughout this whole session is that what we need, or what's obvious, is that we have to ask more questions as consumers of science television about what sort of decisions are being made as to how this comes to us, rather like we did with Frontline in understanding how news is brought to us, that the same sorts of questions have to be posed, and that sort of discussion format, together with all the beautifully crafted adventures that we can have courtesy of David and Heather and Nigel, is a way of drawing out the issues and the complexity that otherwise would perhaps not get discussed.
And Bert, can I just ask you for a last comment? I mean, do you think on the whole, science, fact or fiction, how well do you think we do as programme makers?
I mean, very well, considering the challenges you face. You know, that's the thing. It's not an easy thing to get on top of, because there's so many facets to it. You can't possibly present them all, otherwise nobody would have a clue what's going on. They'd just be a grey fuzz. So you've got to present some sort of story, and generally they're very, very good in terms of fact. It's only some, often the more political ones, which tend to head off onto their own particular fictional agendas, where I get uneasy. And of course, as more and more leverage is put onto filmmakers and broadcasters for financial assistance, then more and more particular people with the money to buy their particular viewpoint will be airing it, and that's the scary thing. That's why the ABC should remain independent of these kinds of, you know, monetary interests.
We have to wrap up. Has anybody got bursting to make a last point?
Well, I just had to pick up on both those last two comments. I mean, as a documentary maker, we love doing things like black holes and universe, but we have to look at the diversity of the media as well as the diversity of science. So Lynn is absolutely right. We have to have these discussion panels where you can have the controversy that you can't put into a documentary, which needs to be a story with a beginning, a middle and an end. Just as when you have a newspaper, you've got news stories, you've got comments, you've got letters to the editor, you've got longer length discussion items, and science has to have all those things, because science is part of human endeavour and it has to be represented in the media like any other human endeavour.
David?
I think the person who has done that to the greatest degree for me personally anyway is Robin Williams on radio in Australia. I think Robin has for 25 years 30 years, sorry, he's actually brought into our living room and kitchen and car and on the beach every Saturday for that period of time cutting edge science, and made it both fascinating, intellectual and sexy.
And he tells the best jokes as well.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, we've enjoyed very much presenting this to you. Thank you for bearing with us, and now we have to wrap. Thanks very much, and thank you to the panel.
Thanks.